This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we have a new guest with us. He has not been with us before. Simon Bowne is an expert in near-death experiences. He's got a book out that really excited me called Verified Near-Death Experiences, Proof of an Afterlife. Now, I've had quite a few people on this show talking about near-death experiences. Are they real? Are they not? Science tells us that we're in here and nowhere else. You die, you're gone. There's, I think, an incredibly nihilistic, false prison. But it niggles with everybody. Will there be anything else? Anything? Well, in my experience, there's a great deal. And what excites me about Simon's book is the word verified. He's done this very carefully, and you'll hear one story after another that's verified, often in extraordinary ways, on this show. Simon's website, by the way, is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. He has a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy. He's done numerous podcasts of his own. He's out there with an alien UFO podcast and our paranormal afterlife. We're going to be concentrating, though, today on near-death experiences. He's had personal UFO experiences, close encounter experiences. We're not really going to get into that. We're not going to get into it because we get into it practically every week with everybody. Here is somebody who really knows what they're talking about when it comes to NDE afterlife. It's a tremendously exciting show. Now, here's a caveat, and I'm so sick of this, I could just scream. There's some kind of video and audio issue with this show. Every time we do something about the afterlife, this happens. I would hate to say it's just the internet, because I don't think it is. I think there's someone or something that interferes. I have, feel like an idiot saying that, but I don't know how else to explain it. Anyway, listen up as best you can and enjoy this show and be empowered by this guy. He's really, really good. Simon Bowne, here we go. Welcome to Dreamland.
Yeah, it's great to be here. It's really nice to talk to you.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad you're happy to be here, because I'm happy you're here too. So we're both happy. All right. Verified near-death experiences. Before we get into the details, I'm going to back up a little bit so we look a little bit more even here. Okay. I was too big. All right. Verified. Let's start with the word verified. Why verified? That's why you're here, because we want verified.
What does that mean to you? Yeah, they're called veridical near-death experiences. And veridical comes from the Latin word veridicus, which kind of means truthful. And it's this thing where somebody will have an out-of-body experience during the near-death experience, and they'll see something while their body is dead, and then later they'll come back and they'll say, I saw this thing happen. And people say, you couldn't have known that happened. You were dead when that happened. Your heart had stopped. Your brain had flatlined. There's no way you could know that happened. So it kind of verifies that their consciousness had left their body, because people don't just see things locally to their body. They'll see things in another part of the hospital or miles away from where their body is. And so for me, it kind of verifies consciousness is not a product of a physical brain. It left the body, it saw stuff, and then it came back when it had to. And for me, that's the verification. And I say in the book, Proof of an Afterlife, because for me, after coming across so many of these near-death experiences, it's proved to me that there is an afterlife, amongst lots of other things that I've looked into: children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, shared death experiences. You know, there's all sorts of things there. So that's why I use the word verified.
Well, that makes sense. And we're going to get into some specific verifications. I've got a, as my listeners know all too well, I do read the books, and I've got a rather long list of questions here. I'm always getting from podcasters, send 10 questions. Well, I never ask for any questions, as you know, and I write my own. All right. Okay. Let's start. We've talked about veridical near-death experiences, and we're going to get into some specifics in a few minutes. How did you start with this, though? Why are you here? Why are you in your death experience space?
It's something that I've always been fascinated by. Even when I was 10 years old, I would get books from the public library about supernatural stuff, whether it was Bigfoot, UFOs, ghosts and things. But over time, I became much more interested in two avenues, which is this afterlife and UFOs. And so I continued reading books as I got older and older. And, you know, the near-death experience stuff started to appear, first of all, with Dr. Raymond Moody back in 1976. I remember reading his book, and it had a real effect on me. And so in the course of making my podcast, you see that I've done 350 interviews, and a lot of them have been with people who've done had near-death experiences, a lot of people who researched them. And so over time, I was in contact with all these people. So most of the cases in my book, the people I've talked to myself and talked to them about their verification events, they verified the chapter when I sent it to them to read it, to make sure it's accurate. And it's just one of those big puzzle pieces that indicate that consciousness survives death, along with children with past life memories and what you can get out of past life regression. And it's the powerful stuff that comes through from mediumship as well. So I got into near-death experiences as one of those big puzzle pieces, and I never get bored of it. It's always fascinating.
Because one of the things that it implies that there is survival after death is that we were there before birth also. In other words, life is a kind of incident in a soul's progression. And what is that progression about, do you think? I feel free to ask you a pretty deep question like that, because you're familiar with not only with near-death experiences, but afterlife regression and memories of previous lives. I mean, memories of previous lives. So a life is an incident in the journey of a soul. What does that mean? Why do we do this? Why do we come into this world?
Well, it seems to be that we're here to learn everything there is to learn about being human. And we come into a life with a set goal that we're going to learn a particular lesson, or it might be something to do with karma. And we can have many, many lives. And my past life regressions, I found three different lives where I was working on the theme of rejection. But also in doing past life regression, I've taken people to past lives and they've been on other planets. So this human life that we have as an incident it could be a life anywhere, basically. And I think sometimes we get too focused on the Earth and think it all happens here, reincarnation and everything. But the Earth's just, you know, it's not a particularly outstanding planet as planets go. It's just a regular planet in the universe. So we have those lives, learning everything it is to be human. So that will mean you'll be male and female, you'll be gay or straight, you'll be born in different countries, different ethnicities, all sorts of things. And it's like with these three lives, which I was learning about rejection. In one of those lives, I was with somebody and we were very much in love. And they said they're going home to meet with their parents for a couple of days. And they didn't come back. And then I got a letter saying they're going to marry someone else. And that was a life learning of that rejection. And in another life, it seemed to be a few hundred years ago in Mexico, and I was living in this small town, and I wasn't very clever at all. And my parents were looking after me my whole life. I couldn't keep a job because I just would mess up. And eventually parents died. And for the town, I became a pain in the neck. It's like the whole town ignored me. Nobody would give me a job. Nobody would give me food. Ended up living on the streets and dying in the streets. So that's a whole other form of rejection that I learned about. So we can see these lives can be very complicated. And when you're coming here to learn things, the different ways you can learn one single thing could multiply over many lives. And sometimes you'll have a life and you won't learn what you were supposed to have learned. And so you have to come back and do it again. And then we get more complicated. Does that mean you'll come back as Whitley Strieber again and live your life over again? Or does it mean you'll be born in another universe, another kind of reality, another timeline? And then it gets more and more complicated. I've had people who are in a past life regression, they were born in one life in like 1940 and died in old age. And then they were reborn again because they had to go back in 1958. So they were living a life they were born in 58 and a life they were living in 1940. Two parallel lives on Earth, the soul split into these two different bodies. And it got to a point where we saw the death of the past life when they're about 90. But then you think, hang on, if they were born in 1958 and they're dying when they're 90, that's 2048. So we started seeing into the future of what was happening with that life. But I think it's all about learning, but I think it's very complicated. My impression of it is very basic, and I don't pretend to have the definitive answers. I've had a lot of experience and got ideas together, but I would never claim to say, yes, I know absolutely what's happening.
Well, you know, there are many, many stories of, let me ask you a slightly different question. And this is something got a lot of past life memories at this point in my life. I was regressed one time, which is somewhere on unknowncountry.com. God knows it's so huge now. Don't ask me where, folks. But if you're a subscriber and you go into the search engine and search on Whitley past life regression, you may find it. I hope you do. In any case, it's about ancient Rome. And I have quite a few, like a cluster of experiences in ancient Rome, and then another cluster of experiences in more modern times, up until the 1940s. And then in 1945, obviously, they stop because I'm born again. Most of them are violent endings. And is a violent death something you're more likely to be imprinted with as a past life memory or not?
I don't think so. I don't come across a lot of violent deaths when I work with my clients. Usually, because I take them through the death of the past life, because we move into the space between lives. And most of the time, they're just very old and they're in bed and they just kind of pass away. When you have a past life regression, one of my theories is that you are shown the life by some kind of spiritual being. It might be spirit guides, somebody like that who knows all of your past lives and might be looking at you and thinking, well, it would be really useful if you saw this past life that would help you right now in your life. So there may be a reason why you would see that cluster of lives and see how they ended like that. And it may be that there was, you know, maybe something that was brought forward into this life that could be resolved by seeing that.
That's very interesting, because I probably remember 10 now. A few years ago, I didn't remember any. But over time, and they come back as very vivid, like pictorial memories is the best way to describe them. And so far, none of them have been pleasant. They've all been violent. And I'm wondering if I can expect a violent end this time, too. Maybe that's what it's about, preparing me for that.
I wouldn't think so. No. I think they showed you that for some reason.
I'm bored with violent deaths. I want a more interesting, slower, more peaceful death at this point.
Yeah, okay, just lie in bed, fall asleep.
Right, for once. But I've also had past life memories of people. Like I remember being my wife's husband in ancient Rome. When I have a vivid memory. It's very dark. We live in a apparently quite a tall building. And I've researched ancient Rome enough to know that there are apartment houses that were, some of them, 7 and 8 stories tall. And we lived in the upper reaches of one of these. And we're very scared because it's extremely dark and it's at night. And we're glad to be home. We're just walking toward the building. And that's the only thing about the memory. But I remember it vividly because of the smell. The smell of the air was very strong. It was very smoky. And ancient Rome, they didn't, of course, know about pollution and talk about it. But if you think about it, with thousands upon thousands of wood fires burning all the time, it must have been really polluted. So, okay, well, let's go down now the road a little bit into some more specific experiences. For example, there's a very interesting story right at the beginning in the chapter called The Peace Above, The Chaos Below, the Barbara story. And I've heard some stories somewhat like this before, but I want you to tell it because I think it's a powerful story. Oh, but before we go to this powerful story, we're going to do something even more powerful, I hope, in the sense it will attract you to the idea of buying the books we're going to advertise and coming and subscribing on unknowncountry.com. We'll be right back.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind. Totally new. Incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon. Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
We're talking to Simon Bowne, and I want to apologize to him. I have been calling him Simon Brown in the same way that people call me Whitley Strieber. There's no R in it. It's Simon Bowne. His website is pastlifelivehypnosis.co.uk. Is that correct, Simon?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. Now, when we left the air, we were getting ready to talk about the story of Barbara. And it's a wonderful story. Why don't you tell us the story, a little bit of the story, and we can talk a little more about it.
Well, Barbara Bartolome had a spinal injury. And the day before they were going to do the operation, they wanted to do a test. And because the operation was going to be at 7 a.m., during the test, the neurosurgeon was there and the orthopedic surgeon was there, as long as with two x-ray technicians and a nurse. And what they were going to do is she was going to be on this bed and they would inject a dye at the base of her skull into her spine. And then the bed would tilt. And as it tilted upwards, the dye would run down her spine and the x-ray technicians could see on their monitors if the dye was leaking from her spine so that the surgeons could see where they needed to operate. And so they injected the dye. One of the x-ray techs had his finger on the button for the table, and he looked round at the monitor and started pressing the button. The thing was, he pressed the wrong button, and the table, instead of lifting her head up, it went head down, and the dye went into her skull and into her brain, and basically that's what killed her. Her heart had stopped, and her brain had flatlined. It's one of the things that I learned from Eben Alexander. He was professor of neurosurgery at Harvard Medical School. He said to me, within about 20 seconds of your heart stopping, your brain will flatline. And when it's like that, it's impossible for your brain to make and retain complex memories. But when that happened and she died, she was up at the ceiling looking down at her body and everything that's going on around her. And she felt so peaceful and fine, and people were suddenly rushing around below her to fix everything, and which would look chaotic for her, which is why the chapter title is The Peace Above and the Chaos Below. And she saw what the x-ray technicians were doing, the surgeons were doing. She saw the nurse on the phone calling for a defibrillator unit to come in. A guy ran in with a box, and he put it on the side, this electric box. He got all these cables with suckers, and you know they stick them on you. And the monitor on this piece of equipment he brought in showed a flat line. So they knew her heart had stopped. And so the x-ray technicians were swapping. They had 2 minutes chest compressions, and then they'd swap, and the other one would do it, and they were doing the mouth-to-mouth. And so she saw all these little things happening while she was up on the ceiling. And she had a bit of a spiritual experience there. There was some kind of spiritual being with her who communicated with her. As far as the verification event goes, after she was resuscitated and after they'd stabilized her, they took the oxygen mask off, and she was like, what just happened? I saw you do that. You did this. I was up at the ceiling. And she just recounted everything they had done. And they knew that her brain had flatlined while they were doing those things. There's no way she could have known this. And she said the neurosurgeon stood next to her, and he clenched his fists, and she said he even clenched his teeth, and he said, I'm not going to stand here and listen to this nonsense, and he stormed out the room. But the orthopedic surgeon sat down and said to her, tell us again what happened. And so she went through it all, and she said the people seemed a bit freaked out, but she could recount everything that happened in the room. But as the hours went on, they stopped talking to her about it, and she realized that they'd made a mistake that had killed her. The hospital was liable, so they didn't want to talk to her about it in case, you know, it came up in a court of law. So that's basically what happened. She was accurate with her recounting of the CPR.
Okay, we get the the side by side straightened here, surprisingly back. You know, the reaction of the neurosurgeon is quite fascinating. That was what is called ontological shock. The shock of facing something that tells you your entire life experience and what you understand of the world is not true. He couldn't handle it. And this is happening to thousands of people right now in the close encounter world, or not in the close encounter world, but among those outside of it. They can't face the close encounter experience, or it becomes obvious that someone from somewhere else is here, the more difficulty people are having facing that experience. Like, I have a relative with whom I'm very close who's never really believed this. But she's always been open to at least listening to my story. But as it becomes more clear that the story is true and that these things are here. Now, I was talking to her just a while ago, and she laughed openly at me and scorned me because she can't handle it. That happened to the neurosurgeon. And one of the things that we are going to, that's going to, shoots through this whole website, this whole program, this whole podcast, this whole website, everything I do is getting past that level of shock so that people who need to understand these things can do that. Like, it wouldn't it have been wonderful if that neurosurgeon had reacted differently and had said, let's look into this more deeply and see what we can do to find out whether or not there are intersection points between established science and an experience like this. Instead, he walked out of the room.
Yeah, I mean, that does happen with some doctors. Like Dr. Melvin Morse was very much materialist, and he had a 7-year-old patient, and he resuscitated her, and she was in a coma. So she never met him while she was ill. But weeks later, when she came back to the hospital for a checkup, she saw him in the hall. And she said to him, I remember you. You were the doctor that worked on me. First, there was a doctor who didn't have a beard. Then you came in. And he was like, hang on, how could you have known that? You were completely unconscious at the time. And so for him, it was a springboard to doing research. And he's done a lot of research now with that. But there does seem to be some people, not just doctors, who are almost like they put their hands over their ears and they're shouting, I can't hear you, I can't hear you. Because it's such a shock to their idea of reality.
That's exactly right. And this whole world, everything that's happening in it is becoming a shock to somebody's idea of reality. Ontological shock is now becoming sort of the basis of the way we live. We're all in it to one degree or another because we're all finding out things we believed about life are not true. And, you know, recently there was one of the government people who's been trying to come out was on Weaponized with Jeremy Corbell he was actually talking to Jeremy Corbell. George Knapp was there, but he was responding to Jeremy Corbell, and he said, this is a dream. This world, life is a dream. And I think you're seeing beyond the edges of the dream in the work you do. I find that absolutely fascinating. Let's talk now. Let's move along. And because I want to explore just in general, it's a wonderful book, folks. And, you know, just an aside, why should you read it? Why should you get it? Maybe you've read near-death experience books before. But you haven't really read one like this. Not that is so affirming. And it's not only is it life affirming, it's afterlife affirming too. The basket, the web, and the sister I never knew. What a chapter. Tell us a little bit of that story, will you?
Yeah, that's the guy that they think that he had. He was bitten by spiders because he had these abscesses and it was like poisonous stuff happening. And man, I'm not sure I can remember much of this story.
Oh, you
got
can't?
Me on that one. All right. There's so much in the book. I'm sorry about that.
Well, yeah, it's huge, full of stories. Okay, let me see. I've got some notes here. It tells the story of Deborah. She had a near-death experience during a car accident and met a sister she never knew. Does that help you remember anything?
Yeah, she was, so when she was 17, she was going to be going to college to study to become a nurse. And she was out one day with her father in the car and they got a green light and they moved forward and a truck came out of nowhere and hit her car and sent it flying down the road. And she was hovering above the car looking down and she saw her father get out of the car holding onto his neck as he came round to her. And it was kind of a brief near-death experience, though she just really had this out-of-body view of it. But she found out later the reason her father was holding his neck is because he hurt it in the accident. But that sort of set her up to have this knowledge, this experience of knowing that there's more to us than just the physical bodies. But she didn't tell anybody about it. She didn't want people to think she's weird because she's going to college soon. She's studying medicine. Yeah. So later she's working as a nurse, and they had a guy come in, and he was badly hurt, and he went into cardiac arrest unexpectedly. And so she was working on him to help him, and it was a late shift. She'd already done many hours, and she said her hair was tied up and it was falling forwards. And one of the doctors came in, a trauma doctor from another place, and he'd been working on a patient there, and he had blood on his clothes from that. And later, when the man was resuscitated, he recounted these things. He said, "I saw you with your hair falling down off your head." And the other doctor came in, he had blood on his clothes. And she was thinking, well, he was getting resuscitation then. His heart had stopped. He was unconscious. There's no way he could have known that. But because of her own experience earlier in life, she knew that he was right and that had happened. And so that's one of the verification events in the book. This guy confirmed it. And so later on, years later, she had a near-death experience, which was much more extensive. And during that near-death experience, when she was in this spiritual space, that man came to her and he saw her and he thought, "That's weird. What are you doing here?" And he says, "Well, where else would I be?" But there was a spirit in that space during her spiritual experience, which was quite extensive, where there was a spirit that had this kind of sister energy to her. And she was thinking, that's weird, because I know my sister and this isn't my sister. And so when she came back, she asked her mum about it, and her mum admitted that there was another girl that was born and that she'd given up that girl for adoption. And so that's how she found out that she'd had another sister that she couldn't possibly have known about. But it came through in that near-death experience. So there's the verification event of her over the car looking down on her father. There's the verification events from the guy that she worked on. And then there's her own verification event with her sister. So that I really like that chapter, because it's quite extensive and there's all this information in there. And it also has the spiritual experience she has. Because in the book, you know, each chapter is a different person, and I describe the entire near-death experience, not just the verifiable events that happen. So we learn about the life review and the spaces that they go to within the afterlife. So, that's Deborah King. That's a good chapter.
Right. Well, I'm glad you recalled it. And Simon's website, by the way, I might have said past life hypnosis. It's past lives hypnosis.co.uk. You can do a number of things on that website. Among them, you can get a past life regression from Simon. And that might be worth doing, because I sense that you're quite an expert. I think I'm right about that. You don't need to, in fact, obviously, if you're interested in this, you want to do this, he would be a good choice. Okay, thanks. Well, let's continue to, of course. I mean, you know, I wouldn't have you on if I didn't think you were good at what you do. And I've had many people that were obviously, in fact, I've even had someone send me a book that was clearly written by AI, where they pulled past life regression experiences out of other people's books and made a book out of it. And they wanted to be on my show. And I thought to myself, well, what I should do is get them on and say, "I see that you've made a book out of AI, and you've copied this experience from this guy and this experience from this guy. How do you account for that?" But I decided, nah, I'll just pass on it. And but this is not the case with Simon. Simon's is the real deal. So if you want past life regression, this might be a good place to go. Pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. Now, here's an interesting question that I played with, and I thought, am I going to ask him this or not? And of course, it turns out I am. And that is, you have, this is basically a book of of experiences. And it builds a sense of conviction in the reader that's very powerful, at least in my experience of reading the book. Now, how did you choose? What were your criteria? Because every experience seems to me you've chosen it to because it has something in it that's extremely convincing. How did you find these?
Yeah, well, just about everybody.
AI, for God's sake.
Just about everybody in the book has been a guest on my podcast. And so I've interviewed them about their experience, talked to them about these verification events. And when I worked out who I wanted to be in the book, then I contacted them. I did further Zoom calls with them. And then when the chapters were written, I sent them the chapter so they could read it and check it for accuracy. So if there was any little things that needed correcting, I would do that. So that's how I found most of the people in the book. I've talked to them myself. They've verified the chapters are correct. There's a small number of people. There's Pamela Reynolds, which is a very powerful case. There's Al Sullivan, which is a great case. And there's a patient, we don't know his name, Dr. Rudy's patient, which is the last chapter in the book. And that's very interesting because that's got the researchers going to find the doctors. They talked to them about what happened and they found one of the other surgeons that was in the room that confirmed it all. And then I have a chapter with very short experiences, but I found those that were from books. Like there's an experience in there that happened in 1906. And this man wrote about his experience and sent it into a newspaper in like 1925. And then I found a book that's about astral projection, as they called it. And back then, the term near-death experience wasn't around. And so there's four or five little experiences there that I got from researching going way back in time. And you know, you can go back as far as Er, the soldier Er, that was Greek, wasn't it? I'm not sure exactly who it was, Aristotle or Plato, who wrote about him, and he seemed to have had a near-death experience. This soldier, that's exactly the same as the near-death experiences now that people report.
Yeah, I don't think that in the distant past they really differentiated those experiences from real life, which is why I don't report them that way. But if you read some of the life stories of that time, it seems to me that there are near-death experiences embedded in the story itself without realizing that it happened after the body was dead and then came back to life. Of course, the other side of the coin is when people died in the past, they often did not come back, not like now. And one of the things about now, and you know, this is in, I think I talked about this in my book about my wife and her near-death experience and her return after she physically died, the afterlife revolution. And that's modern medicine has created a whole now two generations of shaman, because in the past, to be initiated as a shaman, you had to enter the world of the dead and return to it from it. And those shamanic initiations were very, very powerful and often deadly. People didn't come back from some of them because you had to challenge death itself in order to become a shaman or a medicine person in the Native American community. Now, nowadays, this happens all the time. People die and medicine brings them back as shaman, like it did Anne. Anne was, she died and returned and had an NDE, and she just couldn't stop talking about it. It was the biggest thing that ever happened in her life. And when the final days came, she wasn't afraid at all. And she died a beautiful death, hard for me, but not for her. And so, you know, we live in an age of exploding shamanism. Everybody who dies and returns as a magician.
It's just that people come back from near-death experiences. They can be so changed by them because they're so powerful, and they have these after effects where they become psychic and they can't wear watches because they go wrong, and they have amazing synchronicities. And there's all kinds of after effects there. And it's also, they become very worried about the planet, about people around them. They start to shun material things like having a big house and a great car and having lots of money. There's other stuff that's they realize is important. And it's almost like they get people who come back who are trying to spread the word in a way. It's almost like Christians trying to spread the word of the Bible, near-death experiences trying to say, you know, you shouldn't be focusing on just having a big house and loads of money. There's more important things than that.
Yeah, Anne used to say, being rich is fine, but living rich is stupid. And we lived, you know, she wouldn't buy, she liked to live very simply. And after her NDE, even more so. She really liked to live very simply, and we did, and we do. I do still. This is a small flat. It's a two-bedroom flat, no modest building. It's nothing special, but it's where Anne wanted to be, and it's where I want to be because of that. Okay, let's just play a little bit with the book, with the story. Lost in the City of Eternity. It's a wonderful chapter. First of all, tell us what it's about.
I think that's Randy Schiffer, isn't it? The guy who was in a coma.
It's Randy. He found himself in a city after going into a coma filled with people.
Yeah. Remember? And okay. Yeah, he had four different occasions of near-death experience during his coma. So with him, his heart wasn't stopped. His brain hadn't flatlined, but there's many people who have these experiences when they're in coma. So one of these experiences, he entered this past life kind of realm in this amazing hall. And there was a man with him who said, "This is my favorite place. This is the welcoming hall." And Randy thought this was great. It was so beautiful. And they talked a little bit. And then the man said to him, "You shouldn't be here. You have to leave." And so Randy went out through these incredible doors out into the city, which was just amazing. And he couldn't really see anybody around him, but he got the impression they were there. And he started getting lost, and he started getting really worried about that. He didn't know what he was supposed to do. And he sat down on a curb and he was in tears. But then he noticed the stairway going up into the sky. And he thought, I'm going to go up there. And so he started climbing these stairs. And then he heard a voice behind him shout something like, "There's Randy, grab him." And he felt this tug behind him. And then it was blackness. He was back in the coma. And he had this other experience. He got back into that city. He was going up the stairs again, and he looked round this time to see who was trying to grab him. But he got to this point where he saw a face. It was this young man with a moustache, and Randy was getting this message from him. Like, he heard the word veteran over and over. And he also said to Randy, "Tell Madison at the salon that I'm okay. Tell Madison." And then Randy saw a house with a white porch. And this guy was standing on the porch, and he was making all these flags, and he had these red, white, and blue ribbons. And Randy was hearing the word veteran. So when he came back from the near-death experience and he came out of his coma, it took him a long time to recover, but eventually got to a point where he needed a haircut. And this was towards the end of COVID. So things were starting to open up again. And he found this business card amongst the load of stuff, and he gave it to his daughter and said, "Would you book me a haircut with this place?" And his daughter looked at the card and said, "You know, this is Madison. The name on the card is Madison." And he thought, "That's Madison at the salon." So they booked the haircut, and he was sitting in the chair, and he started describing to her what the experience was. And she said, "That sounds exactly like my grandfather that's just died recently." And he thought maybe he'd seen this guy around town. So he asked, does he live nearby? And she said, "No, he lived over 1,000 miles away. He never came to town here." So he couldn't have seen him while he was alive around town. But he got in touch with this guy's wife. Her name was Kathy. Turns out his name was John. And she sent him a photograph of him. And that was him. Exactly that guy in the photograph was the man he saw in the near-death experience. And he got quite friendly with Kathy and the family. And he ended up going to the house. And he was standing on that white porch exactly as he'd seen it. And it turned out that John was a veteran. And that he used to make flags and ribbons and things for, you know, the yearly thing. I'm not sure what you call it in the States. Like, is it Veterans Day or something? But also, Kathy said
Memorial
this wasn't
Day
the first.
The
Memorial Day. Okay, sorry. Yeah, we call it Remembrance Day in the UK. So Kathy said to him, this isn't the first time that John had tried to contact her. And this is another thing with a business card that, after John died, she wondered if he had life insurance. And she was rooting around and she found this card from an insurance company. And she thought, maybe this is it. So she dialed the number on the card and the man answered. And he said, no, that's not me. I've got nothing to do with insurance. And she goes, oh, that's strange. And he says, where are you calling from? What number did you dial? And she recounted the number to him. And he said, oh, you've got the area code wrong. And he said, where are you? And she said, I'm Kathy. I'm in Idaho. I think it was Idaho. And she said, he said, hang on a second. You're Kathy in Idaho? And she said, yeah. He goes, well, I had an accident on my motorcycle recently and I was thrown off the bike and there was a small period where I was floating over my body and I heard a man shouting, tell Kathy in Idaho I'm okay. And this voice kept shouting it over and over. And when the paramedics showed up, he asked them who was there. And they said, no one was there. We're out like in the countryside. It's not in town. And he was all alone. And he's wondered about that. And now all of a sudden, here's this call from this, you know, wrong call, dialed the wrong number from Kathy in Idaho. And John was saying, tell her I'm okay. So that was another thing where he was able to get the message through. But I think about the series of events there. Like John would have to know weeks in advance that Kathy would misdial the call and like he could see the future from the afterlife, or he could take part in the phone call in some way and spiritually affect the system so that the call was routed to the person he wanted it to go to. So that's a great verification there.
It's very powerful verification because it verifies not one thing, but a whole group of things. As you say, he had to know beforehand. He also had to want this. And I can tell you how many experiences, there are lots of near-death experiences that coincide in some way with close encounter experiences. I don't recall reading any in your book. I may have, but they didn't register with me. But when we had our old cabin in upstate New York years ago, where we used to have a lot of close encounter experiences, and Anne would invite people up to who she thought would have close encounter experiences, and they often did. And so often, the dead would come first, or the close encounter experience, so that someone in one room would have a close encounter experience, and in another room they would be talking to a dead friend or relative. That happened frequently. But almost always it was tell X or I'm all right, or I'm all right. I want you to know I'm all right. That is almost a universal message. Now, why do they want us to know this? It has to be, another thing Anne said after she passed away was, it looked like they're all intentionally ignoring us. And do you ever have the feeling that the dead might be using you to try to get through so that those of us on this side of the barrier know that we have more than we feel we do? Because we're anesthetized to this. I don't feel the presence of the dead except under very unusual circumstances. And here is this dead person planning this extraordinary experience out in order to communicate that one message to the one they loved.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I wonder if it's like you say, that it looks like we're all intentionally ignoring them, so they must be around us. So maybe they see you grieving so much and being so unhappy, they want to cheer you up in some way. They're desperate to let you know that they're okay, that they haven't been annihilated and that they still have existence.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably it. They're around. They can see how upset we are when they die.
Yeah, I think so. I think Annie knew after she died how much I loved her. And I think she knew it before, but maybe in a sense could not face the intensity of it. And afterwards, she's was with me for years, very provably, very openly. And she's not so much anymore. But I still carry the torch, of course. After she passed on, I thought, this marriage is not ending with death. I'm going to keep it going. And I think she wants that too. She wanted to set it up the way she did. So now, as far as I'm concerned, we've got two souls and only one body still going. But we'll soon be together again, I think. Okay. The city of eternity. What a phrase. When you have someone asking for a regression, how do you approach that? In other words, if someone goes on your website, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and punches the button saying that they want to make an appointment, what's going to happen?
Well, you can book a 20-minute consultation call that's free, so we can discuss the whole process and we can find out, I can find out what they're trying to achieve with the regression. Some people want to do it just to explore, just to see what comes up. But then there's lots of other people who have problems. Sometimes it's physical, and it could be the relationship problems, or they have this tremendous anxiety for something. And it's a thing where they've got no origin point in this life, where this anxiety comes from. Why are they feeling like this? And so we can go to a past life and find where that originated. And so we'll talk them through in our consultation call how the whole process works, how I do a session, what they need to do to prepare perhaps, and how we might meet the spirit guide, and we have the questions for them. And it's really useful to do that 20-minute call, because that means when we do the session, we don't have to discuss all that stuff. We can get straight into the hypnosis pretty much straight away. And so when it comes to doing the session, first of all, I just ask them, do you have any questions for your spirit guide? And I also say to them, when you're hypnotized, it's just like being very, very relaxed. So you'll still be aware of your surroundings. You'll feel like you could stop anytime you want. You're going to remember everything. And that you just go with the flow. When you get to the point where you enter the past life, it's coming up in your imagination. So you may feel like you're just making it up. And I know how that feels, being through so many of them. But then the lives that we see in a past life regression can be so unexpected, unpredictable. It starts to become very clear that you're not making it up. It's like when I saw this past life, where I saw myself as a nurse in the First World War. Afterwards, the hypnotherapist said to me, would you make that up? Is that something you make up for yourself? I was like, no, I want to be a Spitfire pilot in the Second World War. So, yeah.
Of course, everybody's up.
So we go into the hypnotic induction, which is just me guiding them through visualization and relaxation. And I talk about imagining this really nice warm light coming down through their body, and say things like, every time your heart beats, it sends this warm healing light to every molecule of your body, bringing relaxation. And it's very kind of hypnotic and relaxing. And if you follow it, we get to this point where we're in this really nice garden, and we ask the spirit guides to come and assist us. And we might say to the spirit guides, please show us the past life that would be most beneficial to see today. Or we might say, please take us to the past life that is the origin point of this issue, which might be relationships or, you know, anxiety or something physical. And then I say, at the bottom of this really nice garden that we're in, there's a tall wall with a gate in the middle of it. On the other side of this gate is one of your past lives. So I say, go over to the gate and now step through into that past life. So up to that point, I've described everything for them, the whole induction.
You better be careful when you're hypnotizing me. I'm easy to hypnotize.
Sorry.
No, so, okay.
Yeah, so there, everything's coming to them in their imagination. So I stop describing anything. I use very basic open questions. Don't want to lead them, don't want to suggest anything. So I'll just be asking them, first of all, to find out who they are and where they are. And then we'll move it forward and we'll see what's happening in this scene, who's with you, what are your emotions, you know, and perhaps what do you know about these people. And then towards the end of the session, like I said, we move into the life between lives, a spiritual space where hopefully we'll encounter the spirit guide. But for some people, yeah, their grandparents show up.
We're going to, the first part of Dreamland is over, and I'm going to say goodbye now to my those who watch free.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.